Welcome to Magic the Flavouring, the Magic the Gathering podcast, where we talk about all things magic, flavour design and lore. I'm your host, Andy Mann, and today I'm going to be looking back over some old Commander flavour. Why now, you ask, outside of the fact that this is my show and I can do what I like with it? Well, Double Masters 2 is here. That's right, the perpetual hype steam engine is powering down the tracks, whatever that analogy is. And we now have Double Masters 2, which doesn't seem like it should be linked to Commander in any real sense. I mean, don't we have Commander Legends, Battle of Baldur's Gate, and subsequent Commander decks to worry about? Yes, we do. But there's something about Double Masters as a product that I really enjoy from a flavour perspective and from someone who predominantly plays Commander. We do have, obviously, products that are more suited to Commander and are targeted directly at Commander, and some would say that even standard sets are becoming more Commander-centric these days. And Double Masters, being a Masters set, doesn't seem like the place where you would maybe have to focus in on that exact one format. But the last Double Masters that we had, was a Commander Masters then, the last Double Masters set that we had gave us a really nice spin on some old Magic the Gathering classics, not just Commander staples, but from across the board. And, you know, some of them received new arts in the form of the box toppers, and some of them received new flavour, and there was speculation going around. I think it was, Mox Opal was one, where the sort of hands were slightly different in one of the artworks, and that gave rise to, and it mentioned about Elish Norn or Elspeth could be, not Elspeth, sorry, Elish Norn or Glissa the Traitor could be holding the Mox Opal, and there was like a lot of really nice stuff in there, and things that I think Magic has wanted to do and has wanted to try out and maybe get some new artworks out for, but hasn't found a real place for them in any other set. I'm not going to talk about Double Masters 2 in terms of specific cards that were in there, because the previews are still happening, and depending on whether you keep up with preview season or whether this is something that you look at on a daily basis, or if, you know, there are cards that I might talk about that you didn't know existed, and blah, 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 blah. I'm not here for that. So, suffice to say, there are some very exciting reprints coming into Double Masters 2. And some of those reprints include old Commander cards. And by old Commander cards, I mean Commander creatures that were found specifically in the Commander products pre-Commander 2020, or pre-sort of set Commanders. And this is why I like talking about Double Masters, and why I'm sort of excited for Double Masters 2 as well. I have a bit of a bugbear about Commander products these days, and the bugbear is that they don't seem to be a space anymore for exploring characters or themes or planes of the multiverse that we have not been to before, or haven't explicitly seen in a long time, or seen before, or all this kind of thing. When you tie Commander sets down to a specific set, like how they've been doing since Ikoria with Commander 2020, you take away the ability to look at Commander as a wide-ranging lore and narrative, and focusing in on that one plane. And whilst in the short term, and in the immediate of that standard environment maybe, or that, you know, if someone's really excited for a specific plane or a setting or theme, that's great. Because it allows the design team to do things in those Commander sets with the current theme and with the current plane and setting that they maybe just couldn't fit into the main set because of, you know, format warping reasons and design space, or even just, you know, they wanted to put in X amount of legendary creatures and they couldn't do that for whatever reason, so they put them in the Commander product. Now, this isn't a design podcast from a sort of game design standpoint. This is a design podcast from a flavor and mechanical design standpoint, and they are slightly different. So I'm not going to get into too much of the idea of, well, they seem to be making standard sets, just Commander sets anyway, with an absurd amount of legendary creatures. But those are the kind of pros to having a Commander product tied to your latest standard set. The cons, and this is something that was shown at the time, of a courier and was one of the fears that people had about moving towards these set tied products. One of the many fears, and to be honest, I don't like being a magic alarmist at most of the time, but I do kind of agree with a lot of the sort of worries about the commander products being tied to sets. One of the big worries was, well, the scope of what you're able to achieve within a yearly cycle with your themes and flavor from a game that's fundamental or is based in a multiverse is radically changed and reduced in a massive way. And so I have seen this happen over the past year specifically. And the reason the past year has really got my goat, more on goats later, is because we've had Commander Legends 2 Battle of Baldur's Gate. Now, I'm not going to keep on harping on about D&D and Magic, because as I've said in previous shows, I like that they're doing it. I would never take it away. It's maybe just not for me. And that is still true. The thorn in my side about it, and I think I said this when we heard that this was going to be the second Commander Legends set, was that one of the big spaces that we had in recent memory for exploring some excellent creature design, both old and new. You get characters that people wanted to see finally got cards if they're in flavor text, old characters coming back, brand new characters that had implications on other story bits and bobs from across the Magic timeline and multiverse. That product was Commander Legends. And aside from it coming out as a drafting format in a world environment, a real world environment where people weren't allowed to be in the same room as each other, that's what kept that product so sweet. And I think really put another pillar underneath Commander as being the social multiplayer format that survived and indeed grew in a global pandemic. And so for Battle for Baldur's Gate comes out, and if you're not really that much in the lore, or if the idea of, you know, magic lore versus D&D lore isn't something that you really are fussed about, obviously that doesn't matter. Or, obviously, the third category is people who really love Dungeons and Dragons. I shouldn't forget them. That isn't an issue for you. And also, we've already had AFR. D&D's in the game anyway. But for people like me, and people maybe who have more extreme views of being just really not fussed about Dungeons and Dragons in the same way as magic, having what was, in its first iteration, the sort of apex of exploring multiversal themes within a magic set be completely shifted to the antithesis of that is kind of jarring, you know. And the same thing happens with the Commander sets, where the Commander product right up until Commander 2020. So I'm looking at Commander 2011 through to 2019, and obviously the anthologies and things that are included in that. They ebbed and flowed in the different iterations as to whether they were exploring new characters, characters that people knew but hadn't had cards, characters that needed new cards, or, you know, all of the different mismatches. But they always tried to do something new. And even when individual decks might have had a stronger theme, or like a cycle of decks had a stronger unifying theme than other years, that never stopped them from being able to have characters that were just interesting, you know? And even if you had no idea who, say, I don't know, Tornos was, or you didn't read Kaladesh, so you didn't know who Saheeli was, and it didn't really, you know, mattered to you or whatever, you didn't know if Aminatu was a new character or not. I don't know why these are all from the same cycle of Commander decks. They're just literally the ones that are in my head right this second. Then it didn't matter to you. But to the people who it did matter for, it really elevated the product, you know, to more than just being a format, you know, specific product. It made it something that was really special on different levels. And this brings me all the way back to why I'm doing this episode. So today we're going to be talking about commanders from the different commander products from 2011 to 2019 of cards that I hope to see in future Masters sets, maybe even future Commander Legends sets if they go back to what we're doing, maybe even in mainline sets where I would like to see their lore expanded in some way. These really interesting characters that we have yet to see again, or have yet to have lore made for them, or came into the Commander products without having lore, I want to see these characters fleshed out. And I'm going to go through why they're interesting to me, and why I think they should get more lore, and what implications that could mean if they were to be brought into the mainline story, or indeed if they were to get a new artwork or something, or even a whole new card with new mechanics that would just give us a new spin on this character. How many Thalia, Niv-Mizzet, and Odric cards do we have? Let's get a few of these creatures in. Now, I've got a few ground rules for my own little game here. Firstly, I am only focusing on the Commander products from 2011 through to Commander 2019. So that's none of the set-tied Commander products and none of the sort of future products that we know have certain creatures in them. And by that I mean like the Warhammer 40k Commander decks. We know what one of the Commanders is. Obviously not going to be that. I'm also not doing Planeswalkers, which takes out two of the whole, like two whole cycles of the Commander product, right? So I think it was, if I just have a little look here, we had Commander 2014 and Commander 2019 were both the Planeswalker decks, right? No. Sorry. Commander 18 was the Planeswalker decks. Now, that's not to say I won't have creatures in here from those decks, because, of course, it's not just the face commanders that were the new legendary creatures in any given cycle. We also had the lieutenants of these ones as well were often new creatures that were in the same color identity as the commanders for the face commanders. So, I'm not discounting those cycles entirely. I'm doing five and an honorable mention. So, mathematically, that means I won't be able to get through all of the products in my sort of light little window. And in fact, the honorable mention is in the same product as one of the mainline ones. So, apologies. But this is just for me. This is just for me to have a little look. So, without further ado, I'm going to crack on. My honorable mention for a creature from a Commander product that I would love to see more lore for is Brudaclad. Now, Brudaclad, Tel'kor Engineer, was from Commander 2018, which, again, as those was the newest version of the Planeswalker as Commander cycle. It was from the Saheeli Rai deck. I don't know what the names of all the different decks. I should have looked it up. I'm sorry. It was from the Saheeli Rai face card deck. And Brudaclad is interesting on this list because this is actually a creature that we do have a fair bit of lore for. Now, all of the commanders, well, to varying degrees, they changed over time. Most of the products came with a little insert that told you, like, the lore of who that creature was, like in about two paragraphs, which is fine and appreciated to a point. But considering that some of the creatures obviously had far more expensive lore that we already knew, Saheeli Rai, for example, the face card for the Brudaclad Tel'kor Engineer pre-con, is a Planeswalker character that's appeared in a mainline set. And in fact has had now three different printings? I used to run a Brudaclad deck. It was incredible, and I had all the Saheeli Rais up until that point in there. Yeah, I think it's three. So we do know a bit about Brudaclad. In fact, Brudaclad was also mentioned on another card as well. Some of these are in flavor text. So Brudaclad Tel'kor Engineer was first mentioned in a Future Sight card by the name of Sacramite Mir. The flavor text reads, "A horrible sight, yes, but the sounds, its twanging tendons, its grinding gears are almost musical. Brudaclad Tel'kor Engineer." Now, this is interesting because Brudaclad is described as being a mere-like completed artifact creature who is able to meld flesh and metal into glorious harmony. So I'm reading from the MTG wiki here, which has the little brief that we get going the Commander precons. Brudaclad, during the Time Spiral Crisis, came through a time rift from a possible future of Dominaria, where New Phyrexia had completed Dominaria and taken it over. So this is from a possible future, not an actual point in Magic's sort of main timeline, if you like. So now we're getting not only into multiverses, but into sort of multidimensional. Yeah, that's how I'm going to describe that. The reason I want to see more of Brudaclad, A, fantastic creature design, and B, the kind of mystery surrounding Brudaclad is just too delicious not to dive into. Brudaclad is an intelligent, mere-like being. Not actually described as being a mere, they're an artificer. But they're from this version of New Phyrexia, which A, seems to be more colourful than just all black, because Brudaclad is blue and red, which is an interesting idea of having New Phyrexia be melding the colours. Maybe the kind of the five creators are doing something different, like how they did Atraxa. They're also seemingly more advanced than how New Phyrexia is now. It's a possible future. And maybe because of the Thran technology on Dominaria, maybe Broodcloud's got their hands on that, or their predecessors have got their hands on that, and that's why they're making this advanced technology. And the tokens that Broodcloud creates are 2-1 mirrors, like Sacramite Mirror, which is where we got the flavor text from. But a basic 2-1 mirror, which is obviously more powerful than the 1-1 mirrors that we're used to seeing. Just everything about Broodcloud just suggests this kind of, you know, what if X nation won this war, or what if X army won that battle? And that's always an interesting sort of game theory idea. And just as an extra little tidbit, this is why they're a relevant honourable mention. We are going to Dominaria United and the Brothers War. Now, there are internet theories. I think the Terran Community College has espoused this one that they found on Reddit. The idea that Dominaria United is actually going to be a setup for being Dominaria completed. So the Phyrexians are going to win the war on Dominaria, and that the Brothers War is going to be some kind of timey-wimey thing where Khan goes back in time to fix something in the Brothers War to kind of cut the Phyrexians off at the pass. I don't necessarily know if that's what they're going to be doing, but the idea that Time Spiral Crisis and Future Sight, these weren't things that are like kind of what-ifs. They were possible futures. So some of them have come to pass, or some of them will come to pass. So if an idea of we see a Phyrexianized Dominaria is an exciting prospect, and that is something that could happen in the realms of possibility, having Broodcloud or others like them be involved in the new Phyrexian War is a really delicious concept. So I'm just going to drop that there. Also, as I said, I used to run a Broodcloud deck. It was an absolute beast. I had to take it apart because it came to the point where, like, I don't play CEDH, but the ramping out where I was suddenly like, you know, turn sixing 15 token copies of a Blightsteel Colossus. Yeah, okay, cool. Anyway, moving on to the actual top five. First one we're going to start with is Alloro, Ageless Ascetic. That is how you say that word. I looked it up on Google. From Commander 2013. Alloro is... Excuse me. Alloro is a 3WB legendary creature, giant soldier, 4/5. At the beginning of your upkeep, you gain 2 life. Whenever you gain life, you may pay 1. If you do, draw a card, and each opponent loses 1 life. At the beginning of your upkeep, if Alloro, Ageless Ascetic, is in the command zone, you gain 2 life. Now, this is a, from a gameplay standpoint, an absolute monster of a commander, and was one of the boogeymen of the format. I mean, 2013 was the second sort of cycle of commander decks, because it went the Commander 2011, 2012 was it another anthology? It was the Commander's Arsenal, so that was, yeah, 18 cards, which were kind of like a commander staple format. And then Commander 13 was the second sort of run of decks. So this is a really old school made for commander card, and was definitely one of those ones where people were like, oh, you're an Alloro player. Even nowadays, people still get it, because that ability of doing something from the command zone, whilst being excellent design space, is something that they did again in the tribal decks in 2017, and the Eminence ability, which people hate. Even the less egregious ones, people are like, okay, so you're doing something from a zone that we can't interact with. Fun, I guess. Anyway, we know vanishingly little about Alloro. So Alloro is from an unknown plane, for a start. They're a giant soldier. Being a soldier kind of suggests that they are part of some sort of organization, or at least were. At least that's what I take from it. Alloro, as their ability suggests, is able to manipulate the forces of life and death. They seemingly have, on their given plane, the secret to everlasting life. And they reside themselves on a mist-covered island, where they jealously guard that secret, whatever that may be. Thieves and mystics are said to come after Alloro, and so he has to fend them off, because they're trying to steal his secrets. And he's always on the hunt for new knowledge and gaining more power through that knowledge. And you can see from the artwork as well that Alloro is just humongous, even in giant terms. The kind of throne that they're sat on, with the water cascading down the sides, it's like they're waterfalls. Do you know what I mean? This isn't like a small water feature. This is like a giant waterfall cascading over these seats. And they're sat next to trees that barely come over the top of his shoulders when he sat down. Like, this is a behemoth of a giant, you know, even in giant creature terms. Eric Deschamps is the artist for it. It's a great piece. There are other things about Alora that I'm really interested in as well. First, like, the armor that Alora is wearing is very sort of sleek and sophisticated, which you see giants in armor that's like fashioned armor, like, you know, in different planes, like Ravnica, for example. You get giants in the Boros Legion, which are obviously wearing special plate armor for them. But Alora doesn't seem to be part, even though he's a soldier, and I said that could suggest that he was part of an organization. Certainly not something he is in now. So where is this armor from? Who gave it to him? Why is he wearing it? He looks regal on his throne. There's an air of intellect about him that you just don't see with other giant creatures from across the multiverse. Everything about Alora just does not scream giant. He's the only Esper giant as well. There are no other giant creatures in Magic with that color combination. And there's no red, there's no green. It's the most ungianty thing I think I could think of. If I was to make the least gianty giant in Magic the Gathering, it would be Alora. Now, his secrets to eternal life that he's kind of jealously guarding, and seemingly using as well, because, you know, he has the whole kind of life gain, life tax thing going on. That is a big sort of MacGuffin hook, right, for a storyline. We see it on other planes as well, that there's like this kind of chasing of eternal life. You have characters like Joda, for example, and like on Dominaria, there's like a font of eternal youth analog and all that kind of thing, like Time Water as well. So this kind of sort of endless aging, like endless life, never aging idea is something that obviously a lot of planes have in Magic. I just sort of feel like this idea that there's this one stalwart defender of the secret, be it for their own ends or not, is something that's just really delicious, narratively speaking. And, you know, any number of villains could try to grab that. Imagine if the Phyrexians tried to conquer this tiny little plane. I'm assuming it's tiny. I always think if there's, like, a small island on a plane, that the plane itself is kind of tiny. I don't know why that's ridiculous. But if the Phyrexians tried to come to Alora's plane and come to his island to try and get the secrets to eternal life, like, even just a little dip like that in a side story where just Alora pops up as being this kind of guardian of whatever these secrets are, I think would be very interesting. Anyway, that's Alora. It's not a character that I ever really sort of thought about until I kind of reread these commander cards, and I thought, wow, there's just a lot going on there. Esper is a very interesting colour combination, and so to see a giant soldier in those colours is just enough of a thing where we need a new card, we need a storyline, we need something more from Alora. Alright, next one up is Arjun, the Shifting Flame from Commander 2015. Commander 2015 was the enemy coloured decks, which had experience counters. I have a lot of experience, pardon the double uses of the word there, with Commander 2015. So I started playing Commander as a format, really getting into it at around the time that the tribal decks were about to come out. Not when they came out, but kind of in between. I'd missed the boat on getting the 2016 four color partner commanders. So obviously those flew off the shelves, because that's insane, like, that as a mechanic, and some of those cards are really, even then, were like really pricey. So I think I came into playing Commander as a format sort of in between the 2016-2017 Commander products being released, but on the shelves at my LGS and online, the 2015 Commander decks were selling and were in stock. And I guess because the 2016 ones had boosted the Commander format interest again, they were viable still to sell. So I picked up an Azuri Claw of Progress deck. I also had bought for me the black-white Daxos the Return deck. And just, yeah, all the experience counters just seemed to be something that I saw at a table again and again. Mizzix of the Years Magnus and Merrin of Clan Nel'Toth were obviously commanders that, you know, were incredibly powerful and broken. Nathan has or had a Merrin deck and keeps threatening to rebuild it. The red-white one, Clemny, was also there. But this 2015 experience counters, these decks were kind of iconic, really, in a format where the 2016 decks had already been and gone, the 15 ones were still holding their own. And experience counters have come back as well, and kind of kept making their mark. Anyway, in the Mizzix deck, you had Arjun the Shifting Flame. Arjun the Shifting Flame is a 4 blue red legendary creature Sphinx Wizard, 5/5 with flying. Whenever you cast a spell, put the cards in your hand on the bottom of your library in any order, then draw that many cards. Arjun is not on any other card in Magic. They do have flavor text though, which is he speaks directly into his supplicants' minds using fiery words that inflame their thoughts and incite their passions. Arjun is also from another plane in the multiverse that we have no real reference for. They seem to be standing in their artwork, which is by William Murray. They seem to be surrounded by like pillars and archways, which sort of looks a little bit Therosian-ish, I guess, but they're not a Therosian Sphinx. They're described as being a living puzzle, a shifting maze of enigma and paradox, which kind of lends itself to its red-blue color identity, which has its roots in the wisdom of ages. Arjun also seemingly has a school of philosophers that kind of hang on their every word and treat him almost as a divine being, as a god. Now, the commander products tend to have a soft spot for Sphinxes in their sort of lieutenant spots. You have Shurum, the Hegemon, and Yennet, gifted Sovereign, from different commander products. And Sphinxes in general tend to be the creature type which they tend to have like quite a big impact on storyline and different kind of narrative beats. You look at things like Azor, for example, the Lawbringer, who, you know, was a focal point in the Ixalan stories, but was also a massive instigator in the War of the Spark, you know, who was the person who crafted the Immortal Sun, had ties back to both Ugin and Bolas from back in the day, used to be a planeswalker, and also was the progenitor of the Azorius Guild on Ravnica, as well as countless other planes with their different lore systems, but was never a main character. And indeed, we've never seen them since, even though they are this kind of huge thing. You have people like Alhamrat is another one, and Medabai, the Ageless, like all these big players in Magic that are Sphinxes, and they just don't tend to get their time in the sun. Now, I imagine that's because as characters, they are, by their very nature, aloof and mysterious, and it is hard to have a character that is so intrinsically that be part of the main narrative. But we should be giving these characters maybe more than one card as well. Very interesting with Arjun, the Shifting Flame, is that they are the only Sphinx with red in their colour identity. They're not just the only Izzet Sphinx, the only Sphinx with red in their colour identity. That alone, very much like Loro, is reason enough to explore them further. What happens when you give a Sphinx a red mana base and a red colour identity? This kind of idea that they could be impulsive whilst also having the deep knowledge. What happens if you mix the idea of chaos with mystery? What kind of magic could they produce? Arjun is described as being a living paradox, and you see in their artwork as well, they have like a mane of red magic and a tail of blue magic. Not quite fire and ice, but very, very similar. And we see the kind of, you know, juxtaposition of red and blue in lots of different characters. Think of like Will and Rowan Kenrith. But the idea of is it Sphinx? Imagine what a Grixis Sphinx would do. If it got a new Arjun card and they added black into the mix. This idea that maybe a Sphinx with red in their colour identity has seen the mysteries of the multiverse or seen the kind of deep dark abyss of true knowledge, and with that red passion has decided to go a way of almost like nihilism or, you know, chaotic anarchy in a philosophical or magical sense. It would open up quite powerful, quite dark themes, I think, that they don't tend to explore with these characters that have true and absolute knowledge, because it'd be maybe, I don't know, a little bit too much for any one narrative to contain if you have a character that's almost omnipotent or sees the kind of deeper, darker mysteries of the multiverse to then use that for any great effect beyond like, oh, they're a mysterious enigma. Might be much, but I live in hope. I think Arjun being a red Sphinx is an incredibly interesting prospect, and I desperately want to see more of them. Them as a character as well. It's a commander I actually always wanted to build, but I haven't quite got around to doing. Also, they have this school of philosophers around them. It did make me think, obviously, in hindsight, that this is a card that maybe could have slotted into Strixhaven. We have that whole southern continent of Strixhaven. Of Arcadios, apologies. That is said to contain like wilderness and mystery beyond even what the northern continent where the school is located has. Could this be a bit of a retcon? They've done it in different magic products before. Think about Kaldheim. Interesting. Alright. Moving on. Next up we have Arabo, Roar of the World. Arabo, Roar of the World is a 3 green white cat avatar legendary creature, a 5/5 again, with eminence. Here we go. At the beginning of combat on your turn, if Arabo, Roar of the World is in the command zone or on the battlefield, another target cat you control gets 3/+3 until the end of turn. Whenever another cat you control attacks, you may pay 1 white and a green, or 1 green and white if you're being literal to the guard. If you do, it gains trample, and +X/+X until end of turn, where X is its power. Blimey. The Eminence cards from 2017 really just had way too much text on them, didn't they? I mean, this is the Ur-Cat, right? That's what we're all thinking. This is, if you had the Ur-Dragon, which was also, by the way, another face commander in that cycle, then this is the Ur-Cat. I mean, if you listen to their blurb, it becomes obvious. Like a lion's roar that thunders across the savannah, Arabo's voice resounds through the multiverse, stirring the hearts of every cat and awakening their spirit to his call. A primordial being, Arabo represents the ideal feline. Clever, perceptive, assertive, poised, and a vicious hunter. I mean, if this is an avatar that can transcend the boundaries of the multiverse and the blind eternities, we've seen that before. Now, it doesn't mention anything about Arabo being the progenitor of all cats, which is what the Ur-Dragon is. But, I mean, this is semantics, surely. And if they're not the progenitor of all cats, surely they are, like, the base representation of all cats at this time. How have we not seen more of these Ur-creatures? Again, is it an idea that maybe they're just too powerful? They're a bit too, sort of, deus ex machina for any given situation. Like, they could just resolve a whole bunch of shit that other creatures and other characters can't resolve because of, you know, constraints of power. And that might be a little bit boring, as, you know, sometimes it can be. But I just think of the story potential. If every broad creature type, for example, has an representative, maybe not, like, every single one, but, like, if you kind of do, like, broad swings, looking at you, nagas and snakes, then could you imagine, like, a climactic battle or a cleansing of the blind eternities if, say, the Phyrexians were able to take over the multiverse a little bit too much and start turning creatures, you know, into Phyrexianized versions or starting corrupting the very essence of the multiverse? Or could you imagine, like, an army or a gathering of all Ur-creatures to try and purge and purify with the help of maybe the Eldrazi? Maybe a war between the Eldrazi and the Ur-creatures? I don't know, I'm just a bit walling, but it is interesting that you introduce these characters that are so clearly meant to be one idea, or have the potential to be that idea at least, and then you give them almost nothing else. Now, Arabo apparently does live on one plane, because it's said to make its home in snowy peaks of the mountains on its world, and there are other cats that are on that plane as well, because Arabo is said to tolerate their presence, as opposed to, like, they are an aloof, solitary creature. So maybe they're not as all-encompassing as the Ur-Dragon. If you look at, like, the Ur-Dragon's art from that Commander cycle, they are, you know, exponentially bigger than the other dragons, because the dragons are used as birds of scale in that picture. And, you know, there have been story beats with the Ur-Dragon in it, which doesn't seem to apply to Arabo, but we need to know a little bit more. Arabo is also depicted in the Paul Scott Canavan artwork for 9 Lives, which is an enchantment which has like a house cat, like a tabby, in the center of the art, and in the background you have eight different cats from across magic as sort of the kind of disembodied heads. I think like the Lion King with Simba and Mufasa, and Arabo is one of them. So maybe they are a bit more tangible than being an Ur, but they're a cat avatar. People love cats. There was also another printing of Rabo in the things like the very first Secret Lair. It was part of the first Secret Lair, like Super Drop, in the Kitties Secret Lair. There was an Rabo card, but obviously Secret Lair is not really like canon. We got Edgar without Eminence in Crimson Vow. Pretty nerfed Edgar card, Edgar Markov, who was another face commander from that cycle. We can surely get another Arabo card. Arabo? Arabo? I don't know. Said it too many times now. Moving on. This one's interesting because I remember exactly how I felt when I saw this commander. This is Kestia. Kestia, the Cultivator from Commander 2019. So again, we're back to the Planeswalker precons. This is from the Bant precon. Kestia is from Theros and is a nymph. So Kestia the Cultivator, yeah, is a legendary enchantment creature nymph, 4/4, for 1 green, white, and blue. It has Bestow, 3 green, white, blue, and has enchanted creature gets +4/+4 when an enchanted creature or enchantment creature. Enchanted creature or enchantment creature you control attacks, draw a card. The artwork is by Zenzu Chen, and I remember when I saw this artwork, when they released the images for the cards, which is something they were doing at the time, before, as in the card art, before the actual cards themselves, to kind of drum up expectation and speculation as to what the different products could be. People were very quick to say, oh, this will be in the Bant deck, because we knew what the colours were going to be. I was convinced, as was many others, as were many others, that this was going to be a new Therosian god. I was also convinced, having a soft spot for this particular god, that he was potentially going to be a new version of Karametra, the god of the harvests, which is a character that's famously green-white. Being in that deck, we didn't know that this character was going to be Bant themselves, so it was feasible that it could have been green-white. But even if the character was Bant, the idea and the kind of excitement that this could be a god changing its colours, because we know the gods on Theros aren't like the most sort of stable of institutions. New gods come in, old gods phase out. Gods change what they're representative of. We know, for example, that Heliod used to be the god of love before they were the god of the sun. And that old gods have come back into the fray even after they were phased out. You know, the power of belief on Theros is such that if enough people thought that Karametra was, you know, the god of something that had more of a blue alignment in the colour pie, that Karametra themselves could be blue. And that this would open not just the monocolour sort of like primary gods and then the double colour, two colour sort of secondary tier, but maybe three colour, four colour, five colour gods that kind of all do different, more nuanced things. And I'm sure this is a conversation that was had by the design team. I mean, it has to be. Just look at the artwork for Kestia with the flowing wheat like hair and like the little shoulder sort of pauldron. The look of the character, like in Karametra's artworks, you never see her face explicitly because it's covered over by hair and sort of shrouded by the canopy that she sits under. But this is absolutely Karametra. Now, since this Commander product, we've had another Theros set, and indeed other sets which have had Therosian characters linked to the gods. Think of Scythus, who's a character that I also have a Commander deck of. Transferred my Karametra deck into Scythus deck, actually. From Modern Horizons 2, and then obviously who we had from Theros Beyond Death, we had a cycle of five like champions, demigods was the creature type, which were creatures attached to the monocolored pantheon. Now, Kestia the Cultivator, if we go, okay, right, it's not Karametra, it's not maybe a Pharah, like, you know, and Karametra merged into one because Kestia is carrying a water jug. Maybe then this could have been, and still can be, the champion for Karametra and Afara being the white-blue god on the plane. Because Kestia is said to be, if you look at their little blurb, Kestia is said to be a nymph created by the gods who was given sort of reign over crop growth, fertile fields, and irrigation. Now, if that's not Karametra and Afara's whole deal, in terms of what they bring to the table, Karametra being the god of the harvest, the kind of white-green idea that nature and society are kind of two things that, when they work in harmony, are stronger than when they're alone. If we remember in the story, Karametra is the sister of Nylea. That's the mono green god. And Nylea's whole thing is that Karametra is destroying nature by adding in, like, farming and agriculture and society into the mix. But if you have irrigation as part of that as well, and irrigation being something that, if we look at, you know, ancient Greek culture that then went into ancient Roman culture, because, you know, the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire took a lot from ancient Greece, irrigation is something that Roman cities were very famous for. How is this not where they went with this character, or where then they didn't go within the command product of this character? Now, we didn't see a lot of the supposed god war that was the narrative through line, or the kind of background narrative through line for Theros Beyond Death. Most of the cards focused on Elspeth and sort of Heliod's beef kind of being replayed out once Elspeth escaped from the underworld, which is also supposedly part of the Theros storyline. But there was this idea that the gods were somehow warring at the time, and look, Theros Beyond Death storyline was obviously a complete mess. But I would like to think that if we do ever go back to Theros, or if we get any more products that kind of tackle Theros as it is today, we would see that these Nyxborn creations, these humanoid Nyxborn creations, much like Calyx from Clothis, or like the kind of resurrected, again, Daxos as the champion for Heliod, that we see that some of the two-colour gods were banding together for strength, and that they had their own champions, and that Kestia is the bant one. I suppose Crufix be in the mix there, but it doesn't look very Crufix-y to me. This is why we need these commander products back to maybe how they were before Old Man Shakes Fists at Clouds, because then we get to see these characters and these storylines kind of tied off in a way that sometimes you don't get in the mainline story, if you get a mainline story at all. Again, that's the whole thing with Theros Beyond Death. I really like Kestia as a character. I think their design is incredibly cool, and yeah, I'm desperate to see them again. Maybe with a new card. Although I do like Bestow as a mechanic. Maybe we just get them involved in the story. I say we. Like me and the world-building team are all sat down thinking about it. Okay. This is my number 5. My top dog, as it were, for creatures and commander products that we haven't yet seen and they need new lore for, or new cards, or something to make them relevant again. That's definitely my really succinct brief for this episode. And it is, of course, you knew it was going to be, Ruhan of the Fomori. Found in Commander 2011, the OG Commander Precon decks. This was in the Zedru the Great-Hearted Jeskai deck, or I suppose it would have been America deck, red, white, and blue deck. I don't know whether they were calling it at the time, because I think this was pre-Tarkir, wasn't it? Yes, it was. Ruhan of the Fomori is clearly one of my favourite commander cards, and one of my favourite characters as well. I built this deck twice. This was my first ever deck that I built from scratch. So I had the Daxos Precon and the Azuri Precon that obviously, I took them and I made them my own. Luckily enough, Nathan, who was the person who, I mean, A, got me into Magic in the first place, but B, helped me pivot into Commander because it was something that he was getting into, also had an Azuri deck, so I knew kind of how that was meant to go. The Daxos deck, being a black-white enchantments deck, is a tough ask for new Commander players, even if you have played other formats of Magic. And Ruhan of the Fomori, not only being in colours that I wasn't really playing at the time, was also just a creature that really spoke to me because of the random attack aspect. And I loved the card design. It's also a deck that I took apart after a while because I found it too slow and too clunky. And even at that point in the format's sort of history, like we're talking like, you know, 5-6 years ago, trying to swing in for an attack and knock out even one opponent with commander damage when your commander gets removed on turn 5 and you haven't even swung with it yet because you don't know how to, like, ramp your deck properly in those colours and or protect it or whatnot, is tough going. I think I won one game with Ruhan, and I played it for about a year. I dismantled the deck. Then I rebuilt it recently. I was bored, about 6 months ago, maybe even less. And I thought, I have essentially a Ruhan deck in my bits box, and I've got a whole bunch of new cards from later sets, or just cards that I've splashed out on that should go in a Ruhan deck, and I'm a better deck builder and player nowadays. Ruhan's coming back, baby, and I love it. There's just something so evocative about everything about this card. So Ruhan of the Femori, I haven't even read it yet. Let me read it. Then you'll see. Ruhan of the Femori is a 1 red, white, blue giant warrior legendary creature. 7/7 At the beginning of combat on your turn, choose an opponent at random. Ruhan of the Femori attacks that player this combat, if able. Nice and simple. Down to earth, commander ability, 7/7 so it's evoking the old sort of dragon legendaries of Elder Dragon Highlander of old. And the flavor text reads, unfettered by allegiance, driven by war, with iconic art by Raymond Swanland. Now, what do we know about Ruhan? Well, Ruhan is obviously a giant goat warrior. Goat, interestingly, not being on the creature subtypes, which I don't think would happen nowadays. I think if we got a new card, they would absolutely put goat on there because people love goats and squirrels and all those dumb creature types that the unset seem obsessed with. So I think that would absolutely be a thing. And I bet you anything you like, there are some Ruhan decks out there that are sort of rule zeroed to be goat tribal. Guarantee it. Ruhan is from the plane of Ir, which is a plane that we have seen technically before in a couple of different places. So we've seen Ir on the, most famously, on the Planes Chase product plane card of Turi Island. So Turi Island was one of the plane chase plane cards from Ir, and depicts, Turi Island, obviously, which is the sort of Femori fortress, and it's completely like craggy, barely chiseled out of the rock fortress looking thing in a very rough sea. And to me, this evokes a lot of the kind of isles off of the coast of Scotland or off the west coast of Ireland, for example. And it's never fully confirmed, but just by the look of Ruhan and Femori Nomad, which is another card which we get which ties itself to Ruhan as well. So actually, out of all these ones, Ruhan we do have a bit of stuff going on with. We do know kind of what they're about. This kind of stokes to me the kind of Celtic and Irish aesthetic of the British Isles, which we have had things like Lorwyn and Eldraine in recent history, so I don't think we're going to go to Ir, but it's kind of things which I think they were starting to approach. Now, I also thought when we got to Kaldheim, I think long-time listeners of this podcast will know one of my little theories is that the Kaldheim, far from being just the Viking plane, was maybe going to be slightly more interesting in terms of it going to be sort of like barbarian world. So you have different continents on the plane of Kaldheim that take their cues from different barbarian societies throughout history. So you'd have like the Picts or the, you know, Vikings as it was, or the Celts or the Gauls or whatever you're doing. So you could have characters like Saskia the Unyielding, which is another commander face card, for example, being floated in there. Or, you know, even some of the cards or characters that I think, you know, if you think of like Conspiracy and Fiora, a lot of those kind of Roman centurion looking characters, you could have, you know, that kind of aesthetic be brought in as well. As it came to pass, that's not going to happen. So I just don't think we're ever going to go to this plane in a mainline set anyway. However, stranger things have happened. And I do think that these kind of goat warriors would be something that would be a really, like, fresh and ripe idea. Oh, that's a very fruity analogy. It'd be something that we could really play with and have a lot of fun with. Also, mechanically speaking, if you look at Ruhan's ability of having to attack each turn of Abel and attacking at random, this is something that Magic in the most recent sets have leaned into almost to excess. Goad as a mechanic, you know, attacking each turn of Abel and having to attack a player, you know, other than the person who gave that creature goad. Forcing an attack, making them have to attack each turn of Abel. The randomness of the Ruhan's attack. We've just had the D&D sets, which not only themselves have a lot of goad, as did things like Nukapena, but dice rolling has become huge in the game now to kind of tie in with Dungeons & Dragons. And having a random aspect, you also saw another commander that I play which is Zavai the Thunder Conductor from the Strixhaven precons, is another one of deal damage to someone at random. So something that the Magic design team still keep coming back to. And I think having maybe a fresh Ruhan card, or maybe more cards from the Fomori that follow this idea, would be something that you could absolutely see in modern day Magic. It'd probably be even more egregious. Now, there is something about Ruhan which I've never been wholly comfortable with in terms of a character, and it's just because I just wonder how sensitive it can be. So Ruhan is a character. We haven't spoken about Ruhan as a character particularly. Is a horned giant who just loves war, and everything about them is about battling and fighting. He has a mace as his weapon of choice, but he has been trained by the famed swordmasters of the Fomori. So these big, dumb joke goat giants-looking things clearly have some sort of sophistication, or at least military prowess, because to have a title of swordmaster, famed swordmasters even. And Ruhan fights for his own impulses. Now, he speaks of himself in the third person as well, which is kind of fun. Because you see on the flavor text for Vow of Lightning, at least the Commander 2011 printing of Vow of Lightning, you do see the flavor text read, Ruhan would never agree to such terms, Ruhan of the Fomori. So that's cool. Also, Vow of Lightning, that particular printing, I do actually wonder if that sort of disproves my idea of Ir being a slightly sort of Celtic and Irish looking plane, because if that flavor text on that card and that artwork by Svetlana Velenov is also depictive of Ir, maybe it's just Turi Island that kind of follows that aesthetic. Anyway, I digress. Now, Ruhan is also blind, and you could sort of tell this if you just looked at the art for Ruhan of Fomori, because they're wearing a blindfold across their eyes. It's just the fact that because of the art style and the kind of the way that the art is incredibly busy and there's a lot of movement, and also the band across Ruhan's eyes has an eye depicted on it, I think it's actually maybe something that's kind of easily missed. But Ruhan themselves is blind. Is the blindness represented by the fact that Ruhan attacks randomly, or is the attacking randomly thing because Ruhan is really thirsty for war and battle? It's always something I've been slightly uneasy about, just because I don't know how much I love the idea of using someone's disability as a mechanic. Maybe that's just me reading into it. I don't know. I still love the card, and I think it's a lot of fun. But that always does make me go a little bit like, "Huh." I'd love to talk to someone who's visually impaired to maybe get their read and get their take on it. But yeah, there we go. I just think that the Fomori are an incredibly interesting race of creatures. And again, their stature is huge. Maybe a little bit like the Sphinx. This is my problem when I was talking about Aloro and Arjun. Maybe these creature types are kind of relegated to the secondary tier of protagonist creatures, because they are, as Watsi often fears with their planeswalkers, just something we can't really relate to, or the logistics of having them in a story. Imagine trying to write a story where a giant that is literally 50 foot tall has to also rock around with a group of adventurers or planeswalkers that are themselves between, 4 and 6 foot. it's maybe too tricky. I don't know. All I know is I love this card, and I love the Fomori, and I want to go to Ir, and I want it, and I want it all, and I want it now. And make a Commander Legends set that's actually about Magic the Gathering, so we can have, 70 creatures that at least one of them can explore this better. Okay? Cool. Well, that does it for me and the commanders that I'd love to see in future Commander or miscellaneous product. What's the word? Ancillary? I really don't know what that word means. Let me know via Twitter at MTFlavoring what commanders from the 2011 to 2019 Commander products specifically you would like to see. Also, let me know what commanders you would wish to have new art, maybe, or new cards entirely. I know there's the elephant in the room that I'm talking about this with Double Masters 2. Amonatu, the Fate Shifter. Again, a deck I used to play. It has been reprinted with the Sir McKinnon art. Sir McKinnon is obviously not Magic's favourite child at this time because of his problematic views surrounding the rallies in Canada and the coronavirus vaccinations and rules implemented. I'm not going to get into it. All I'm saying is people were really excited to see a new Aminatu art, as there is a bunch of key art for Aminatu, and there just wasn't, or at least at time of recording, there hasn't been. I know I said at the top of the episode I wasn't going to reveal any cards, and I've just revealed that Aminatu's in the set. Apologies. Emails go to mtflavoring@gmail.com. My personal Twitter is @AndyManface. Nathan's is @TheFoxInTheMoon. This has been a completely convoluted episode of the podcast, but I really enjoyed looking back at old cards, and I think it's something that more people should do as well. I know, obviously, we're a niche in a niche, as a podcast goes anyway. Talking about the lore and flavour in Magic, despite it being such a huge part of the game, is something which is still not as represented, say, as gameplay mechanics or format, you know, staples, or, you know, just current news in general, which is perfectly fine, and that's just the way it goes. But it is interesting to me to talk about flavor in Commander, it being the sort of giant, we talked a lot about giant state, but the giant format that it is, and having the flavor of the deck be something that's so huge. It is always interesting to me to talk to players who maybe aren't quite as invested in their Commander's lore as I am, and as Nathan is, and many other people we play with. And that's fine. It's different strokes for different folks. All I would say is that if you're listening to this podcast and you're maybe not as up to it as other people, which is A, why you listen to this podcast, but B, just check it out. There's some really sweet lore about Commanders, even if it is not much. And yeah, see which ones you think deserve more. Maybe what's your listen? Alright, thank you so much for listening. This has been Magic the Flavoring.